This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Ira Flatow is away. One of the big themes during the election campaign was jobs, bringing jobs back to America versus outsourcing jobs to nations overseas. But many of the jobs lost in recent years aren't exactly moving. They're being replaced or modified by automation. And while people may be able to imagine a robot welding car frames, for instance, it's a bit harder to wrap your mind around how advances in automation and artificial intelligence could affect other industries, like workers in a grocery store. My next guest has been studying automation in the workforce, and in a new report issued today, he and his co-authors estimate that almost half of the activities people are paid to do around the world, yeah, half, could be automated using current levels of technology. But it might not happen right away. So you think your job has a future? Our number is 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK, or tweet us at SciFry. Michael Chui is a partner at the McKinsey Global Institute. That's the research arm of the McKinsey consulting firm. He's based in San Francisco and joins me today from KQED. Welcome to the show.
Hi there, John. It's terrific to be here. I'm a longtime SciFry fan.
Oh, well, I'm glad that you're here. And well, let's talk about this. What do you mean when you're talking about automation? What exactly are we talking about here?
Well, we are talking about the use of technology to do things that people are currently paid to do in the economy today. One of the things that we did in our research is not only look at the level of individual jobs, because we think it's actually quite rare that you'll have a robot that comes in and can do everything that a person does, or an AI program and does everything that someone does in their job. In fact, less than 5% of occupations is that true for. We looked at things at the level of individual activities, because everybody's job is made up of different activities which have different potential to be automated.
So you're looking at the job itself, but then you're breaking down all the various activities, and you're saying some of those activities could be handled by a robot helper of some sort.
That's exactly right. In fact, almost everyone's occupation has a significant percentage of activities which potentially could be automated using technology, whether it's physical activities or cognitive activities. Some of the things that we find so amazing are that artificial intelligence now is opening up the possibility for some of the things that previously we thought that only people could do with their brains now can be done with machines as well. And what we found is that the potential is really widespread. In about 60% of occupations, over 30% of the things that people do, these activities, could be automated either using robots or artificial intelligence, machine learning, deep learning, all of these technologies that we're hearing more and more about.
Well, we'll talk about some of the AI technologies. Maybe you can give us an example, because the history of automation so far has been a lot of blue-collar jobs being taken away by machines that can do that type of work. With artificial intelligence, now you're maybe talking about white-collar jobs, things that humans have thought that only they could do.
That's right. Over history, we've usually thought about automation affecting frontline workers, low-wage and relatively lower-skill activities. You know, that's one set of type of activities that we found is relatively automatable using the technology that we've seen demonstrated today. But another set of activities, those that are around collecting data and then analyzing that data, are also things that we're starting to see some of these artificial intelligence techniques be able to take over as well. And some of those are lower wage activities, things that a clerk might do, somebody who's processing financial transactions in the back office of a financial institution. But in fact, some of those activities are things that we're paying very, very high wage and high skill folks to do as well, some professionals. And so again, if you look across the professions, again, whether it's a marketer, whether it's a physician, whether it's an attorney or an accountant, a significant percentage of what they do is in fact collecting data and analyzing data, and that's increasingly susceptible to automation as well.
When you talk about wages, that's going to be one of the key factors as to how much automation is actually used. So if you've got someone either in the United States or somewhere else in the world making a relatively low wage, the calculus has to be, will building a robot to do some of that work actually be more cost efficient than just paying somebody not very much money to do that same work?
That's absolutely right. And that's what we think is, you know, part of the contribution of the research that we've done, which you can, by the way, just download off the web. Because, again, we hear about these amazing things, whether it's self-driving cars or computers that can read lips better than a professional lip reader. And you say, you know, gosh, how... you know, that's incredible. You know, won't suddenly all these activities we pay people to do, just be automated tomorrow? And we try to break out the fact that it's not just having technological feasibility, but in fact, you need the economics to work out. You need, in fact, the cost of automation to be outweighed by all the other benefits, and only some of those are reducing labor costs. And then, by the way, even when you do have a positive business case, it still will take time for all of these automation technologies to take place. When we looked at history, we looked at any type of technology that's been adopted over time. Usually it's taken something like 8 to 28 years between the time it was commercially available and the time it was fully adopted throughout the economy.
You know, we've talked a bit about physical work and about cognitive work. I want to go to Lisa, who is calling from Fayetteville, Arkansas, because you're asking about something else that humans do. Lisa, go ahead.
Yes, sir. I'm a registered nurse. And I do believe that nothing can replace that human touch. In healthcare, I know that there are many things that machines take over. There are robots that can do things much better than a human can do surgically. But part of nursing is that holistic approach. And I don't see how human interaction can ever go away from that.
Lisa, it's a great question. Michael, what do you say to her?
Well, a couple of things. Healthcare is as we talked about, so many different activities incorporated into healthcare. And as we studied it, absolutely, some of the things that will be hardest to automate over time are, in fact, interacting with people, being able to understand their emotional state, being able to understand a patient holistically. Ironically, some of the things that are perhaps more automatable are some of the higher paid activities in healthcare. For instance, if you think about a physician, some of the things that we think about them as being their highest value is doing differential diagnosis, that is collecting data and analyzing data. And so ironically, there are a number of people who think the practice of radiology might be easier to automate than the practice of being a nurse, like our caller.
Well, and another thing that your study looks at that I think is fascinating, it gets to the question of what's going to happen as more automation takes hold and potentially more people are forced out of jobs. You say that the healthcare industry is one place where we're going to have such a need because we're getting so old as a society, people are living longer, that maybe more people will get jobs in healthcare but leave a lot of other jobs to the robots.
That's exactly one of our other findings of the research, because what we've discovered is over the past 50 years, about half of the sources of our economic growth have come about because we have more people working. We have a growing population thanks to some immigration, as well as just more people being born, as well as more women in the workforce, et cetera. But as the country ages, that demographic dividend is basically going to disappear. And basically what we're saying is we need not only everyone working, but all the robots working too, to make sure that we actually have enough economic growth. Now, that does mean that people's jobs are going to change. Like I said, a significant percentage of all of our jobs could potentially be automated. And that means we're all going to have to retrain. We're all going to have to understand how to adapt as we adopt technology. And so sometimes we've described it as, you know, we worry a lot about mass unemployment. What we ought to be doing is trying to solve the problem of mass redeployment. How can we continue to have people working alongside the machines as we go forward?
Yeah, Hayes has a question along those lines. He's calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hi there, Hayes.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
I think you got the wrong person.
Oh,
yeah,
I do?
Oh.
Go ahead, Hayes.
Sorry. I think you got the wrong guy.
I think we had two people on the line at once, and that was probably my fault. I want to ask you about the timeline here, Michael. You know, what are we talking about? If so many jobs that we have right now or tasks at our jobs could be replaced right now, well, are we looking at the next 2 years, 5 years, 20 years? What's the timeline look like?
Well, that is one of the things that we try to contribute. And again, we can't predict the future. We don't have a crystal ball, but we tried to lay out some of the scenarios for how long it might take for some of these things to take hold. And as you mentioned before, we talked about 50% of the activities that we currently pay people to do could potentially be automated by adapting those technologies that already exist. But then how long might that take? And when you factor in the additional technology development that has to occur, when you factor in the economic business cases that we talked about, and then just the natural curve of adoption, that 50% might not happen until 2055. We also modeled out scenarios that occurred 20 years earlier and 20 years later than that, but that's roughly a work generation. So it might take some time. Now, two other points about it. One is, if you look at history, it actually, this level of change in what people do is not unprecedented. Around 1900, about 40% of the U.S. population was involved in agriculture. Now less than 2% are, and we don't have 30% unemployment because, in fact, we found new things for people to do in the economy. So we have, in fact, historically been able to do that. But what that does mean is that everyone is going to have to be able to shift in terms of the activities they do, and that's part of the challenge going forward.
Yeah, there's the economic business case, but there's also the political case, too, that might affect your timeline. If there's a push to keep more Americans in the types of jobs that they have right now, perhaps that means that we push off some of the automation that many industries are probably clamoring for.
I think a lot of those factors come into play. There's a political question. There are also questions about what one finds acceptable. I mean, there was a time when people would say, you know, if I go to a bank, I want to talk to a person because, you know, this is an important financial transaction. I don't want to deal with a machine. And, you know, since then, a lot of people are now transacting either ATMs online or on mobile, et cetera. And so that, you know, again, as we talked about that adoption curve, different people will choose to use automation in different ways over time.
And we're getting used to those electronic personal assistants that are in our pockets right now, and they seem pretty helpful. I don't know. I want to thank Michael Chewy, who's a partner at the McKinsey Global Institute. Thanks so much for this interesting study and for being with us today.
Thanks very much.
When we come back, we're going to get a little twisted and a little naughty. We're talking about molecular knots. That's next. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky in for Ira Flatow. There's an unseen process that probably happens to you every day. You take your earbuds and you put them in your bag, and when you pull them out later, they've become a knotted mess. How that happens is a mystery. We're not going to solve that today. You tie your shoes, you wrap a present, you go camping. We may think we know a lot of knots, but did you know that there are more than 6 billion different kinds? Many of these twisted patterns often occur naturally on the molecular scale. Strands of DNA and protein are packaged into these orderly tangles. Now scientists have created the tightest molecular knot using chemistry. The results were published this week in the journal Science. My next guest is an author on that paper, and here to tell us how you tie a molecule into knots, David Lee is a professor of chemistry at the University of Manchester in Manchester, United Kingdom. David, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on the show.
So first of all, explain what exactly a knot is.
So in mathematical terms, a knot is a closed loop that's got entanglements in it. So the knots that we tie in shoelaces and that Boy Scouts tie, those are open knots in terms of mathematics. They're still knots, but if you close the end, then you get a knot as a mathematician would understand it.
Okay, so tell us about the difference here with molecular knots. Explain what a molecular knot is.
So a molecular knot is just where you take a molecule and you tie it into a knot. And that's what we've been doing in our laboratory, learning how to do that.
Yeah. Okay, you've been learning how to do it. Explain it to us. How do you do this?
Well, the strands that we're knotting are so small that you can't grab the ends and mechanically tie them like you would a shoelace, say. So instead we use chemistry and a process called self-assembly. So we mix together organic building blocks with metal ions and chloride ions in a solution. And these metal ions are sticky in particular directions, and the organic building blocks wrap around the metal ions, forming crossing points in the right places that we need, just like happens in knitting. And then once all the crossing points are formed, the ends of these building blocks are then fused together by a catalyst to close the loop and form the complete knot.
And why is this important to do? Why are you tying these molecular knots?
Well, there's many reasons. As you pointed out, that knots in molecules actually occur in biology, in DNA and proteins, and they form spontaneously in polymer chains. But as every Boy Scout knows, different sorts of knots have different characteristics, which make them more or less useful for particular tasks. And knots should be just as important, versatile, and useful in the molecular world as they are in our everyday world. But we can't exploit those things until we learn how to tie them.
So explain some of the exploitations. What are the things that you would do with molecular knots, especially ones of the type we're talking about here, tied very, very tightly?
Knotting and its counterpart weaving have always led to breakthrough kinds of technology. So even for prehistoric man, knotting allowed him to make tools such as fishing nets and axes with blade ties to handles and how to weave fabrics to keep him warm. So it should be possible to use knots to do similar sorts of things at the molecular level to make new kinds of materials which have got new sorts of properties or beneficial properties. So in our everyday world, we know the benefit of weaving fabrics. Say you get materials that can stretch in different directions, hold their shape, and they're light, strong, and flexible. Hopefully we'll be able to use the same concepts that we're learning about how to knot molecular strands. We'll be able to use that to weave molecular strands. They're very similar concepts, and use that to make plastics with similarly advantageous properties.
Well, let's talk about those properties. When you knot a molecule, it has a different structure, but what different properties does it have then?
Well, again, it's just like in weaving. Perhaps you can get beneficial properties that make it more flexible and stronger for the same sort of or lighter for the same sort of strength. So, for example, take Kevlar, which is a very strong plastic used in bulletproof vests and body armor, and also car brakes and so on. So its chemical structure is actually lots of tiny straight molecular rods that pack together like sort of pencils stuffed in a pencil case. So if we could weave molecular strands into molecular fabrics, maybe we'll be able to get the same sort of strength as those kinds of materials, but with a much lighter and more flexible material.
So we led by saying that you've created the tightest known molecular knot with 8 crossings. So tell us about this, how this is created and the strength that it gets from this very, very tight, compact knot.
These strands that we're making are really small. They're just half a nanometer across. That's less than a millionth of a millimeter or 10,000 times thinner than a human hair. So we're talking about really tiny kinds of structures here. The loop, the strand of the knot, is just 192 atoms long. It's got 8 crossings in it. So that's just 24 atoms for every crossing that occurs in the knot. That makes it the tightest knotted physical structure known. And we're interested now to finding out how that actually affects its physical and its chemical properties, because again, as every fisherman knows, actually tying knots in a strand can actually make it weaker. That's the weakest part of a knotted strand. But if we are able to weave strands, conversely, that can make a material very strong.
So why is it that with these 6 billion known knots, it's so difficult to synthesize these? We've only been able to come up with a few. What, obviously, they're very, very small. What else? What makes this difficult?
Yeah, it's about being able to gain control. Being able to control whether the crossings go under and over in exactly the right sort of ways, and it's learning how to do that, which has been difficult, but now we're getting to be able to make more complex knots than are previously possible. And using the techniques that we've learned, we're now able to braid actual strings, just like one braids a child's hair. We're beginning to braid molecular threads, and that allows us to access many more of these sorts of knots than has previously been possible.
Wait, and then what's the next exciting thing you're working on?
Just because we can tie knots doesn't mean that we can immediately go to weaving. So just because I can tie my shoelaces doesn't mean that I can knit a Christmas jumper. And so we've really got to learn how to be able to connect the knots or extrapolate from the knots to weaving the sort of weaves that we need to make two-dimensional materials, just like the fabrics that we have in our everyday world.
Well, David Lee, thank you for this interesting, knotty conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
David Lee is a professor of chemistry at the University of Manchester in Manchester, UK. Teenage Indecision. It sometimes feels like they're doing it just to torture you. My next guest, though, says that when we consider bad teenage behavior, well, it might actually be an asset for the adolescent brain, even though it might not be doing us adults any favors. Joining me to discuss what might be going on inside the teenage brain is Laura Hale. She's a collaborative researcher at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies and co-author of a paper out this week in the journal eNeuro. We're going to find out what we can learn about this from roundworms. Laura, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first of all, how are we going to connect the teenage human brain to an experiment with roundworms?
So to back up a little bit, we are looking at the worm because it's a simpler nervous system. And we are interested in understanding the nervous system. And if you think about humans' brains, there's about 100 billion neurons, and then worms only have 300 neurons. And so we want to kind of take these kind of general principles about how the nervous system develops in a younger worm and then try to apply these to people.
Okay. So we're using roundworms here. And maybe you can describe the experiment first. The thing that struck me is that buttered popcorn is somehow involved in this?
Yeah, so it's the buttered popcorn flavor. So worms are really good at moving through the world through their sense of smell, and so they navigate based on odors in their environment. And so it turns out that the buttered popcorn smell diacetyl is a metabolic byproduct of bacteria, and this is a food source for E. coli, or excuse me, for C. elegans, these little round soil-dwelling nematodes.
Okay, so what did you do? So you've got this buttered popcorn smell, which, by the way, is making me find buttered popcorn less and less appetizing all the time as I read about this. But anyway, so what do you do now? You've got mature roundworms and you've got adolescent roundworms and you've got this buttered popcorn smell. What happens next?
So basically we probe how well these worms respond, different stage worms respond to the odor. So adults are very, very good at responding to this buttered popcorn smell, and the younger worms are not very good at it. They kind of wander all over a plate, and we basically have these small plates about a cup, and you put an odor on one side, you put the worms in the middle, and you see where they go across the plate. And the young worms just don't go directly to the odor. They kind of wander around.
So the young worms wander around. The adults go right to it. So why is this? What do you think? Is that the adults know that that's a good food source? What's happening here?
So that's what we're expecting is happening, is that we speculate that the adults are finding this going directly to the odor because they've had a lot of experience with bacteria that produce this diacetyl scent. So they can reliably depend on this odor, this bacteria being, this food source being in their environment, whereas the younger worms haven't yet had a lot of experience with this particular food source that might contain diacetyl. And so they're wandering all over the plate because they want to get a sense of what is happening in their environment, and they don't want to become dependent on a food source that might not be available later. So the adults have had, we guess, a lot of experience with this diacetyl odor, and then as they so they learn to migrate to that odor really reliably, whereas the younger worms, they're testing their environment out and trying to sample different things.
And what's happening in the brains of these worms as they're doing this?
So the really cool finding is that we found that adults have additional neurons, multiple neurons that are active during in responding to this diacetyl odor, whereas the younger worms have a smaller population of neurons that are responding to the odor. And so we think having more neurons in the case of the adult that are responding allows the adult worm to encode more features of their environment around them.
So if you have a different sort of stimulus, what happens? So if you've got this yummy popcorn smell, adults go for it, the adolescents sort of swim around a little bit. What happens to a negative stimulus is in there?
So interestingly, both stage worms, both the teenage and adult worms, really respond similarly to a negative odor. If the situation is going to be harmful to them, they both run away from the odor.
Okay, so they both run away from the negative odor. So what does that tell us about how adolescent worms are learning about their environments?
So basically, it seems like they're hardwired to respond to anything that might harm them. But they haven't yet learned what kind of sort of positive food sources are in their environment. So this gives them the flexibility to find additional positive sources because, you know, not having the chance of becoming dependent on a single food source can be detrimental in the long run if that food source isn't available later. But the negative food source is always going to be a problem for both the adults and the younger worms. So it's important to learn to avoid those negative things in your environment and then learn to adapt to potentially multiple food sources that one might not be as good as another, but if it's going to allow you to survive by providing you some nutrient substance, then you will continue to, continue to explore your environment.
I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking with Laura Hale. She's a collaborative researcher at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies and co-author of a paper out this week in the journal eNeuro. And we're talking about what roundworms can tell us about potentially the teenage brain. So what do we know about how this might be happening in humans, too? I mean, is it safe to guess that the teenage human brain might be working somewhat in this way as well?
So what we're thinking is that there's these different stages of development and that there's this stage during transition to adulthood that it's really important to have some flexibility in how you accommodate sensory information in the world. And so this is just a different kind of normal stage along the process of becoming an adult, and that you have in the teenage brain this kind of flexible plasticity to your brain to learn new things, and then this allows you to perform certain tasks as an adult much, much more efficiently.
But does that also tell us something about, you know, as we get older, we're always told it's harder to learn when you're an adult, and it's much easier to soak in information when you're a kid. Is that part of what we're seeing at work too, that the teenage brain is just more plastic, more able to soak in all this various stimuli so it can figure out what the world around them looks like?
So that's kind of the next thing that we would like to try, is actually test whether your experiences matter. So this study suggests that your experiences during adolescence affect your adult experiences. And so we would really want to probe whether your experiences during the adolescent stage affect the adult. And then also similarly, whether you can change as an adult, have different experiences, and that also alters your performance. So I think we can learn new things both as an adult and the young mind, and we shouldn't restrict ourselves to thinking that this time period has passed and we're no longer flexible.
Hmm. Are there any other takeaways that you have about what we can learn about the adolescent brain from studying these roundworms?
Yeah, it's a really great system for understanding how behavior originates all the way from individual cells. So we were able to look at individual neurons and then also go look at molecules within those and just go from individual cells to behavior to the organism. So this is a really cool feature of studying worms that isn't possible in humans at this.
Yeah, and so what's the next thing there? I mean, if you're able to get it down to the cellular level, what else is that telling you? Where do you go next with this research?
So one of the things we can look at is perhaps what is different in these neurons? Why are different sets acting in the adults versus the younger ones? And then what's going on at the molecular level inside of those neurons to make them respond to the odor better?
Well, Laura Hale, a collaborative researcher at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies and co-author of a paper out this week in eNeuro, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. I enjoyed this. This is exciting.
It was exciting to have you. After the break, a blood test could help athletes know how long they need to rest after a concussion. We're also going to look at the growing body of research on the dangers of those little hits to the head that happen over time that don't qualify as concussions. We'll be talking about that when we come back. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Anyone watching last Sunday's NFL game between the Miami Dolphins and the Pittsburgh Steelers might have seen it. A huge hit on Dolphin Matt Moore's chin took him to the ground. He was unable to stand up for a few minutes. Yet afterward, he was checked for concussion by medics, and then he was sent back to play almost immediately. Moore said this week he doesn't have any concussion symptoms, but is there an ironclad objective way to be sure a player is ready to dive back into the game, whether the same day or a week later? And what about the growing body of research that's linking small hits, so small they don't register as causing concussions, to degenerative CTE? We're going to be talking about concussions, sports, and brain health with two researchers in the field. If you want to join us, our phone number is 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. Dr. Jessica Gill is a clinical research scholar at the NIH's National Institute for Nursing Research and chief of its brain injury unit. She's in Washington, D.C. Dr. Gill, welcome to Science Friday.
Great. It's so great to be here. Thanks so much.
And Dr. Robert Stern is professor of neurology and director of clinical research at Boston University's Chronic Traumatic Encephalopathy Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Stern, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, John.
We're going to start with you, Dr. Gill. Tell us about your research and what a blood test can tell us about how bad a concussion is.
Sure. So one of our recent studies, which was a collaborative study with Dr. Jeff Bazarian at University of Rochester, showed that elevations of tau in the blood of athletes within 6 hours of a concussion were predictive of a prolonged return to play, such that these elevations could distinguish those athletes that had a concussion and needed to be out of play for more than 10 days from those athletes that had a concussion and could go back to play within 10 days, which is what we would consider a healthy or a normal return to play. And so in the study specifically, what we looked at was tau, and we looked at it in the blood. And from what we know from other studies is that tau is a really sensitive indicator of brain injury. From more severe patients, we can see the elevations of tau relate to the severity of the neuronal injury following this. And they also give us an idea about how these individuals will recover. So the higher the tau is, the less prognosis that they'll recover within a normal period of time. But the problem we've had in this area of science is that we're not able to measure tau in the peripheral blood in a sensitive and reliable nature because it's in such low concentrations. So really, when we're looking at tau, we're trying to measure grains of sand in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. Mm. And so only recently have we had the ability to look at tau in a more sensitive way. And so we've linked with Quanterix, which is a biotech company outside of Boston, and they've developed the ability to look at tau using an ultra-sensitive assay that allows us to reliably quantify the amount of tau and look at these more subtle changes following these more mild type of concussions. So really allowing us to do this type of work.
I would like to back up a bit and just maybe have you explain what tau is and where exactly it comes from.
Sure. So tau is a protein. And what happens when a neuron is damaged by injury is tau is released from that neuron. It then goes into the cerebral spinal fluid, and then it goes into the blood eventually. And so that's really where we're trying to measure it, because that's where we can clinically make relevant decisions about return to play.
Mm. So when it comes to concussions, how much variation is there? I mean, we were talking mm-hmm. about Matt Moore getting hit and there's no concussion. Some people have terrible concussions with one kind of hit. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Sure. So there's a huge variation in response to a concussion. So one athlete can have the same injury as another athlete, but have a completely different recovery trajectory. But what we know from a lot of studies is that most athletes will recover within 7 days to up to 30 days following a concussion. But there is a subset of athletes who will go on to have chronic type symptoms that Dr. Stern can talk more about. And so what we're really trying to do with these tests is to identify that subset of athletes that will go on to have these chronic symptoms so that we can monitor them over time and then provide preventative interventions that mitigate those risk factors.
So Dr. Stern, we're finding chronically elevated levels of tau protein in former football players, people who've played the game since they were children. Is this linked to having multiple concussions over their careers or something else?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's something else. One of the things that I study is this neurodegenerative disease, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And what we know about that disease is that the necessary variable for getting it is a history of repetitive hits to the head. Now, that includes those symptomatic concussions that Dr. Gill has been studying, but also what we refer to as subconcussive trauma, meaning the many, many more frequent hits that football players and others get that don't result in the symptoms of concussion, but still might do something to the functioning of the brain cells. And so what we've looked at is the relationship between the total number of estimated hits former players received over a lifetime, not the number of symptomatic concussions, but the overall number of hits, including those subconcussive hits. And we looked at the same type of blood test that Dr. Gill's group looked at, this plasma tau developed by the Quanterix company. And we found that there was a very strong direct relationship between the total number of hits these former players got earlier in life and now the total amount of tau in their blood, suggesting that maybe we're seeing the leftover stuff that Dr. Gill's finding, or maybe we're now seeing something new as an objective way of being able to detect this brain disease later in life.
So this is really interesting, Dr. Stern, because we're talking on one hand about these elevated tau levels being present after a serious hit to the head that results in a concussion, and then wondering when to send a player back into play after that level has lowered. But what you're talking about is over the course of time, this building up in someone from a series of very small hits. In some ways, they almost seem like two different things, but for someone who's been playing football for their entire lives, you seem to be suggesting that these very small hits are what's building up.
Yeah, I'm not even sure if it's what's building up as much as perhaps evidence of a progressive brain disease that also results in the release of this tau. Mm-hmm. So there's two different things. One is the acute injury that releases this bad form of a protein. And then there's the disease that occurs in some people that progresses over time and results in the destruction of brain tissue. And again, we might be seeing that tau that can be measured the same way. But what we're looking at is really not those acute big hits that result in the symptoms, but rather those multiple repetitive hits that some, even youth players, 8 to 12-year-olds, might get a couple hundred per year or more per season. And they don't rest in between at all because there's no symptoms. And so they keep on getting hit after hit after hit, and the natural ability of the brain to clear out the bad stuff is unable to work well, and that might result in the development of the beginnings of this brain disease later on in life.
And I'm going to get back to that in a moment, but I want to turn to Dr. Gill and ask, so if tau protein is also linked to CTE, what about the athletes you studied? Should they be worried that if they had this big spike in tau, even if it was a short-lived spike from a major concussion?
So that's exactly where we're going with the next directions for our research. So how do these acute changes in tau after concussion, especially this individual variation where we have some athletes having a lot of tau coming into the bloodstream, and how are those individuals then at greater risk to have these more chronic or long-lasting symptoms? And so we don't just look at CTE, we look at symptoms across the spectrum. So we look at things like post-concussive syndrome symptoms, including headache, to behavioral symptoms, to things like light sensitivity. And so we know that these have a big impact on quality of life, even if they don't progress on to CTE pathology. But we want to understand and target those athletes that really have this higher risk for those symptoms and try to understand the nature of that risk and how can we monitor those patients and those athletes to provide greater monitoring and then prevent those risks over time.
I want to go to a phone call here. Hugh is calling from Silver Spring in Maryland. Let's go to Hugh. Hi there, Hugh. You're on Science Friday.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. My question is, and this is, you know, interesting as a former football and lacrosse player, all the hits I took to the head, you know, jokes aside. Is there an analogous blood test or attention being paid towards testing for duration of effects in, say, traumatic brain injury in combat veterans?
So actually, we've looked at tau in combat veterans also. We found that elevated tau in individuals who had a deployment-related brain injury in Iraq or Afghanistan had higher tau when they came back from that deployment, even years after that, and it was linked to chronic symptoms of neurological and behavioral change. And so we do see that this elevation of tau is related to both blast exposure as well as this blunt force brain injury that they often sustain during deployment. So we have seen that tau seems to shape the recovery from that type of brain injury also.
And that might lead to some of what you're looking at, Robert Stern.
For sure. You know, one of the big things that Dr. Gill's work has done is it's leading to the ability to measure in an objective way when the brain is hurt by one of those impacts. Right now, the definition of a concussion involves the clinical examination, person has to have symptoms. They have to complain. They have to have problems in an examination. But so many people don't want to complain for lots of reasons, you know, the macho thing or the lack of being able to stay on a team. And so there's been this tremendous need to be able to measure what is a concussion objectively. And Dr. Gill's work is moving us tremendously in that direction. For me, since I'm also interested in what happens when people keep on getting hit over and over again, whether it's in the military or in contact sports, if we don't have the ability to measure changes in the brain because there's no symptoms, so we don't stop them to play and then, you know, take some type of test, we want to be able to figure out what's too much in terms of those repetitive hits? What is putting someone over the edge in terms of changes to their brain? And so using the types of tests that Dr. Gill is developing for concussion might allow us to kind of lower that threshold and be able to detect brain injury objectively without the person having the symptoms of concussion. Mm-hmm.
I want to go to Alex, who's calling from California. Hi, Alex. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a sports medicine physician out here in California, relatively novice in my career. And I have a question and a comment. My first question is, when you're doing this research into CTE, are you looking at I think of CTE and dementia pugilistica, which is a much kind of older diagnosis, as almost the same thing. And is there any sort of difference when you're thinking about this from a clinical and a research point of view? That's my first question. And second of all, my comment is, I see these kids in clinic every day who are absolutely terrified of being active, of doing anything where they might possibly hit their head, because they're scared, rightfully so. I mean, there's so much we don't know about concussions, and I really feel like a lot of this media attention is sometimes scaring our kids away from being physically active, which is potentially having more of a detrimental effect long-term on their health than, you know, a couple concussions here and there. So my question, my comment, I'll take my thoughts off the air. Thanks very much. Great.
And Alex, thank you so much. Thank you so much for the question. Before I get to your answer, Dr. Stern, I just want to say that I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Go ahead, Dr. Stern.
Yeah, those are both fantastic questions. The question about dementia pugilistica or punch drunk brings up a very important thing. We've known about this brain disease and the long-term consequences of repetitive head impacts since the early 1900s, when it was looked at in boxers and looked at the long-term consequences of getting your head hit over and over again in boxers. And that was originally referred to as punch drunk, then dementia pugilistica. And then in the 1940s and 50s, it was starting to be referred to as chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, the more general term. But it wasn't until the early 2000s that people started playing attention to it, when our beloved American football players started to die, and their brains were examined, and they were found to have the same thing as the boxers had. So to answer that first question, dementia pugilistica is really the same thing as CTE. We're just talking about it a lot more now. And that leads to the second question, which is, you know, what's happening with all the hype surrounding CTE? Is it leading to too much fear? Is it leading to kids being afraid that they have one concussion and they're going to, you know, become completely impaired the rest of their lives? So there's a couple ways to answer it. One is, people should realize we're still in the very early stages of our research of CTE, and that people don't have to be concerned that a concussion, you know, even a big hit, if it's on its own, or even a couple or three, is going to have long-term consequences. And the caller was so astute in saying that we need to keep our kids active. We need to keep them involved in wonderful sports and athletics for overall health. But we have to ask the question, is it appropriate for kids, especially whose brains are developing, to expose them to repetitive hits to the head that may be altering the successful trajectory of their brain development? And that's one of the things that we're really trying to focus on, is what's going on when kids get their heads hit over and over and over again, not necessarily the big hits and the symptomatic concussions.
Yeah. Dr. Gill, before we run out of time, I want to ask, though, what are we learning about concussions, how to treat them, how to prevent them in the first place?
So we're really looking for new treatments for concussions. Right now, when a patient comes into the clinic, and I can also respond to the other callers, you know, I'm a parent too. I'm a concerned parent who has two kids playing competitive sports who are risk for concussion. So if I bring them into the clinic, I want to be able to understand the nature of their brain injury and how quickly they can go back to play and how they can have those successful trajectories that Dr. Stern's talking about. And right now, we're really not at that place. We don't have any treatments to mitigate the risk of concussions on brain function. And so we're really understanding the mechanisms. And so that's why we're focusing on these blood biomarkers to understand really the individual variability in response to concussion and how can we identify those patients at risk and then do individualized treatments to really modify those risk factors. So that's the focus of research moving forward. And it's really an exciting time to be in this area of research because there's so much collaboration and so much excitement going forward to look at this very critical and complex issue, to address it through multi-modalities and many scientists coming together to address this issue.
Dr. Jessica Gill is clinical research scholar at the NIH's National Institute for Nursing Research and chief of its brain injury unit in Washington, D.C. Dr. Gill, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Dr. Robert Stern, professor of neurology and director of clinical research at Boston University's CTE Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Thank you, Dr. Stern.
Thank you very much, John.
B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Thanks to our production partners here at the studios of the City University of New York. If you missed any part of this program or you'd like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcast. You can point your tablet or smartphone to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you can also join our mailing list. Tell us what you'd like us to cover, too. We'd love to hear from you. If you like us, you can like us on Facebook, too. Continue a week-long discussion on Twitter, at SciFry. As always, again, email us, SciFry@sciencefriday.com. Iris back next week. In New York, I'm John Dankosky.